Hey everybody, welcome to the Vet Tech Cafe. The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses, hosted by myself, Dave Cowan, and my good friend Jeff Backus. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. One thing we would ask of you, our listeners, is to rate and review us on whatever podcast platform you're using. We're not exactly sure how or why this helps us, but apparently it does. If you have questions, comments, or would like to be a guest on the Vet Tech Cafe, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. So without further ado, come on in, grab yourself a cup of coffee, and get ready for another episode of the Vet Tech Cafe.
Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe this evening. It's 8 o'clock here on a Thursday night at the Vet Tech Cafe. Dave, how are you doing down there?
Doing all right. We're just kind of getting done with the first week of classes here. It's a lot of setup, meeting some new students, which is great, and just getting all set up for everything. I got labs starting next week, so you know we're going to do the social distancing thing because we are still in phase two down here in North Carolina. How are you doing up there?
I have a couple week lag time here. I am no longer a full-time employee at Tufts. I'm now per diem. Molly had kind of finished up her internship, so we had a vacation plan that, of course, got canceled. So we had a nice week off to just relax and kind of do some day trips that we, you know, in New England that we hadn't gotten to do yet, and just enjoy the warm weather. So we've kind of been doing that. And I don't actually go back to work until I have a couple of overnights, I think Monday and Tuesday of next week. So I still have a few more days off. But
that's good.
Yeah.
You need it. You need the break.
Yeah, kind of nice. You got a cup of coffee down there?
I sure do. Got my iced black silk.
I can't wait to tell you what I'm drinking. You're going to be so disappointed. Are you ready?
Probably not, but go ahead.
Pumpkin spice. I found it in the grocery store the other day, and I am so excited.
No words.
I know.
You're doing great there for a while. You had some really respectable things.
Yeah.
I was even okay with that. Didn't you have something that was like a coconut coffee? I was actually okay with that a little bit.
Yeah. Nope. The Vet Tech Cafe has gone back to basics.
Basic is right. I'll tell you what.
Yes. So I sent you an article today that I got that was in today's Veterinary Nurse. And I think it might actually be...
It's from last year, I think.
Yeah. I was going to say it's a little bit of an older article, but certainly timely, and it's something we've talked about on the podcast, and it's definitely something that is firmly rooted in veterinary medicine and being a veterinary technician and not going away. But the article is titled "How to Avoid Burnout in Veterinary Nursing," and certainly we could have a whole other discussion on veterinary nursing and the title and all that. But I kind of want to stay away from that for this talk. But you read it. What did you think?
As I was reading through, and this is, we should mention, this is Emily Fullerton.
Yes.
She's a VTS in oncology. She works apparently in Maryland. I'm not sure how up to date this is. That's who wrote the article. And just reading through this, it's just heartbreaking to read stuff like this is happening everywhere. Like she talks about working at her job and really loving her job and being a really dedicated technician, working overnight, and then realize that, I'm not making enough money. So she took a second job. Like, how many of us have more than one job? It's so upsetting that technicians, like, at the top of their game, still having to work two jobs to make ends meet and be fulfilled. It's just, that was one of the big takeaways for me is that's probably a big part of burnout. And we can kind of go down the rabbit hole of everything that leads to burnout. But, you know, not making as much money as you feel like you deserve to make. And then to supplement that, you work your butt off and you burn the candle at both ends. And then suddenly you're, you know, that typical cynical technician that's so seasoned and weathered and just angry at the world because you're doing something you love, but it's not allowing you to live.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that I took out of this was that we have to be better. We have to find ways to make this better for us because otherwise technician turnover is going to not stop and it's just going to continue to happen.
Yeah. I think, I think one of the takeaways for me and kind of along the same lines there is, I mean, I remember when I was working overnight ER and I was actually kind of still living at home and I didn't necessarily need extra money, if you will, to make ends meet because I was living at home, but I still was working, you know, nights at one job, but that was only three nights a week to get full time because in California it's only 32 hours a week for full time status.
Yeah.
So in three shifts, I had three 12 hour shifts and I still had like 4 days off and I was like, oh, I can still work at, you know, this other clinic and do this other thing. And I wonder if that's something in us as well, that even, you know, I sometimes wonder if I made $50 an hour and was more comfortable, would I still have the desire to just pull extra shifts if they were there? Maybe not necessarily get a second job, but would I still work overtime? Like, well, is that something fundamentally wrong with me? I don't know. Like,
I think I have an answer to that. If you were making $50 an hour and the job paid $50 an hour, there wouldn't be a technician shortage.
Possibly, but
so you wouldn't. There wouldn't
but at
be
the same time.
There wouldn't be overtime shifts to work.
But then I'm going to go to, okay, well, if it's time and a half, then I can make $75 an hour.
Okay. All right. I see what you're
so,
saying.
So, you know, like I wonder if for some of us, if we just fall into a little bit of a trap like that as well, and then that's where it comes into, right, taking care of ourselves and like having to set up our own boundaries.
Yeah.
And the other thing that I really liked in here was that there was a couple of things that I think she put in here to kind of help recognize some of these signs and
right.
You know, it talked about like weight gain or being angry or retraction from interaction with loved ones, you know, a whole bunch of different things that I think there are a lot of us that probably experience that we just either don't recognize or don't want to acknowledge.
Yeah.
But then, you know, there are some takeaways as well here about how to kind of keep it at bay. And the last one that they talk about is, don't be ashamed to talk about it, especially in the hospital setting. And
right.
whether it's you individually or even if you, you know, if you feel like an entire staff is dealing with something, don't be afraid to be the one to speak up for the group and go to your manager and say, hey, like, I feel like we need to have a conversation here. And again, it's something we've talked about quite a bit, and we will talk about it more, and we'll post a link to this article. But but there's, you know, it's good to see. I think that the more that we see this kind of stuff in print, hopefully the more people see it, the more they kind of, unfortunately, recognize some of these things in themselves. But then ultimately, hopefully, can take action.
Yeah. Well, another thing she talks about is, you know, it's not, I don't like reading things that just spell out the complaints. She actually gives solutions too, mm-hmm. where she talks about employers recognizing and understanding the value of licensed veterinary nurses and veterinary technicians, paying them accordingly, valuing their mental health.
Right.
And these are things that we've talked about with other guests. We've talked about this in Mental Health Month. How do we get that message to our employers to say, hey, look, here's the problem. This is what we need to do to fix it. Help us come to solutions to fix these things. So,
right.
You know, we talk about a lot of these things as being technician problems, but they really shouldn't be technician problems. These should be management problems of valuing our employees. I think she also even talks in here about almost mandatory time off,
mm-hmm.
like forcing people to use their paid time off.
Right.
You know, as much as we just need the money, I need to keep working. We talk about what Joe brought up. You can't pour from an empty glass.
Right, right.
And recognizing that as employers, I think, is really important as well. So if there are employers out there, maybe that's something that we need to do in the future is talk to some employers about how are you making technician lives better and what can we do to help?
Yeah, that's a good thought. So, well, what do you think? Should we put this back on the shelf and
yeah, we could probably talk about this article all day. But
I know. Well, we'll post a link to it in the show notes. But but super excited for today's episode because we've got somebody coming on. She's a VTS and ECC like us, but she also does some really cool stuff in a very different area of the profession, and that's always something we try to talk about. So we have Lisa Smith coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. She has over 25 years experience in the field of veterinary medicine. She has a bachelor in fine arts in 3D fine art with a concentration in metals from Moore College of Art in Philadelphia, PA, and studied animal science at the University of Delaware. She became an LVT in 2008 and obtained her VTS in ECC in 2014 and graduated with a Master of Science degree in Veterinary Forensic Sciences from the University of Florida in 2016. So we'll talk a lot about that tonight. She lectures on topics including recover, CPR training, wound management, triage, biosecurity, and veterinary practice, which sounds fascinating. And of course, veterinary forensics. So all kinds of really, really cool stuff. And she also serves on the board of the Delaware Veterinary Medical Association as the technician representative and is on the advisory board for the Delaware Technical and Community College Veterinary Technician Program. So, Lisa, thank you so much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe. What can we get you for a cup of coffee?
Hi, thank you so much for having me. I think I'm actually going to go with Dave's favorite, which is iced coffee.
Mm. Thank you. Thank you.
And coming I'm also right going to go on the pumpkin spice boo train because...
that's fair.
Sorry.
I have no problem about that, and I will continue to drink it.
I think it's fantastic that you drink it, but just not for me.
Can we make that a hashtag? Can we make that a hashtag?
Boo pumpkin spice.
Pumpkin spice boo
no
train.
No pun intended, but yes.
So Lisa, we kind of always start out with our guests kind of taking us through their career path because we all kind of take varied paths to get to where we are. And with especially with the forensics, you've definitely gone down a road there that I know not a lot of people are familiar with. So if you don't mind, just kind of where you got your start in veterinary medicine and all the way up to where you are today, if you could just take a couple minutes and take us through that.
Sure, I'd love to. I guess it's a little bit of a winding road for me with lots of bumps and, you know, potholes and the whole nine yards. So I actually... This was not my intended career path. I'm an artist. I was an art major in high school. I had originally gotten into School of Visual Arts in New York City when I was 17. My mom said, we're not going to do that. it was 1987 at the time, if that tells you anything. So she was like, you're not going to move to New York. So I had always really wanted to do that. I ended up losing my cat one year and I just missed him so much. I wanted to go work in the veterinary hospital. And I thought, well, I'm just going to be a receptionist and I'm not going to see any, the thought of sticking an animal with a needle was horrifying. And I ended up in the back of the hospital one night because they just needed more hands. And I was, I'm very happy being client services oriented. The next day I got pulled into the office and the doctor said, I thought I was in trouble because I thought, oh no, I shouldn't have been back there and I don't know what I did. And they said, I would like you to be my assistant. And I'm like, oh, what does that mean? I don't really know what that means. And I guess that day kind of was very changing for me because I had just gotten into art school and was kind of doing both. I ended up getting into vet school in 2005.
Oh, wow.
Because I was like, oh, I want to be a surgeon. I'm great with my hands. I love things that are slightly gross and morbid. I kind of like dark side type things. So like, forensics and the such. So I actually planned to go to vet school. In 2005, I had my car, I had my house, I had all my books, I had everything ready to start. And I had a niece that was born in June of 2005. And she had special needs. She was born with a genetic translocation. And I ended up staying behind. I was deferred for two or three times. I deferred. And I ended up just staying behind to help take care of my niece because we weren't sure what the outcome was. Luckily, she just turned 15 years old.
Oh, wow.
And she is the purest person on the planet and the best girl in the world. So she's very, disabled, but she's an incredible person. And I'm so glad that I didn't go to vet school because that's what led me to where I am now. But I basically, the fact that I still want to be a surgeon, there's a lot of things that I can do technically that fills that need. But I continued on. I also really like learning and I like being busy. I like school. so that's why I went on to get my LVT. From 2008 to 2013, you could become grandfathered in Delaware because I did not go to tech school. I'm one of the ones who I'm listening to your podcast. It's amazing how many of the techs that I know and admire so much are grandfathered techs, I think is just kind of a hot topic for me, is being a grandfathered tech with a VTS, not able to work in other states.
Right, right.
Whole nother topic. But so I basically got my LVT and then my VTS. I found out about the forensics program and I think it just was really fascinating and I really didn't realize you could do all these things and that the fact that it even existed was great. I was one of the first people in the program and I was the first tech in the program and graduated with a master's in 2016, at the end of 2016. So I really just wanted to be Quincy Emmy when I was little. I really just loved... I'm much nicer. I don't yell at people, but I do love Quincy. And it's, the fact that I can combine both of these things is really incredible. Even though I was an artist, I still had a science interest using both sides of my brain, I guess. But that's kind of been my path. And I'm just, I'm very happy to be a tech. I still don't really have a desire to be a doctor as much as I would love to be a surgeon.
That's awesome. One question I have really quick. I know we're going to talk a lot about forensics here in a bit, but you said you were the only technician in that program. What kind of other walks of life, if you will, were in that program? What kind of other professions were in there?
It was mostly doctors.
Oh, okay.
Mostly veterinarians that were in the first. This was the first group group, I should say, we were the first class, really, that was like, it actually started as a certificate program.
Okay.
And it was only 5 courses. And in the midst of my 5 courses, they turned it into a master's degree, which was thrilling because I'm like, that's great. Because I was really sad to be done. I was like, no, we're only 5 classes. That's it. There has to be more. And bam, there it was. So they actually also put it under wildlife. Like, they have a whole section under wildlife now too, which is really interesting. I didn't take any of those classes because they're not as pertinent to my job. Not that I wouldn't love to do that and find it fascinating, but lots of other actual professions that were in my class as well. I actually have a friend who works in Florida, and she was an FBI agent, and she now does exotic I'm trying to get this right because it's a very specific job. It's basically the illegal importation of exotic animals and animal parts.
Okay.
Like gallbladder. I mean, this is not my special area, but I think it's like the gallbladders of tigers or bears or something, and they're imported and sold on the black market. And so she's doing the forensics on that type of thing, which, again, completely fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't really know a ton about it, but her FBI background is incredible. There was a lawyer in my class, mostly veterinarians that were in my class. Okay. But I do know a couple of other people that are now in the program that are technicians.
Oh, awesome.
So they are increasing in numbers, which is really good to see.
That's super cool.
Before we get into all the fascinating things about forensics, another thing that we've been trying to ask a lot of our guests is, what is one thing that you love about your career as a veterinary technician, and what is one thing that you would change about it if you could?
Gosh. Well, the one thing that I love, I mean, I love dogs. Like, I could never have a job anymore where there are no dogs at work. I know that that sounds ridiculous, but it's funny because when I graduated from art school, I got a job as graduating with a degree in sculpture, I would say your options are very limited. And I actually applied to the Danbury Mint. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but it's basically like the plates of like the WWF wrestlers and maybe a sculpture of Derek Jeter. You know, those are the kinds of things you would be making as an artist. And so I got that job. And I said to my, I mean, they were going to pay me a lot of money to make these type of things. And I said to my mom, I'm like, Mom, I can't do that. There's no dogs there. And she's like, oh, no, you spent so much money on this art degree that you're going to go work with the dogs. So that's what I'm going to do. Hey. So I do. I love the animals. I love my team. I'm a manager also. And my team is, I don't have children, and they are my children, even though some of them are close to my age. I just love the profession. I love the people. And I love the animals. I love both of those things. They just bring a lot of joy. I also love that I get to do so many different things. I get to do management. I get to do team building. I like to create levels. I loved working with patient safety. The CPR things that I've done is incredible. Anesthesia, surgery. I mean, I get to do so many things. And it's such a variety that I don't think a lot of people have that.
Right.
So I think there's a lot of things that I love. I think the thing that I don't love is the negativity. I find that it can very easily bring down a whole hospital. Mm-hmm. And I think that the mental health issues are becoming more prevalent. I mean, I've been doing this a long time, and I know that I don't think I'm quite as isolated in Delaware as most people would expect, because I mean, Delaware is still, I mean, it's in between lots of really cool areas, mm-hmm. and it's not really like the worst place in the world, but you know, I think that we're pretty representative here in Delaware of what is happening in the field. And I do think that the negativity and the mental health issues are, it's a little bit like a vicious circle. And so I try to work with my part as being a manager, you know, just listening to your discussion about the article that you've talked about. And every time I hear it's a management problem, it's a management problem. I feel like I don't take it personally, but I have to constantly recognize that I'm a manager and I'm the person who can make that difference of being the person who can either be there for someone and really get it, or be the problem. And so I really think that that's a lot of pressure, and it's really hard because I see both sides, but I also know that that's me responsible ultimately. So I think that's a lot of weight on my shoulders, I feel. Sure. But I think that the negativity, I really work actively every single day to try to combat that negativity as a manager. And I really just wish that I didn't have to spend time on that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you know, Dave and I have been doing this, you know, probably in the same, at least ballpark, you know, length of time as you have. And same thing. I mean, I know myself in my role at the veterinary school. And what really worries me is I see it with students, veterinary students that I'm already worried about, you know, and they might not actually go into clinical practice. Like maybe they go into research, or maybe they specialize and, you know, become a radiologist, and, you know, everybody kind of has their own little niche, I hope that they find. And then I also have, we get a lot of employees that come straight from vet tech school, and I see it, you know, just kind of already starting out. And sometimes I wonder, is it me and my generation, not necessarily my age, but me and my generation of technicians that are there, that are we more vocally bitter than, or carry ourselves in a different way than we realize, and that's just what they pick up? Or are they already 6 months out of school, 12 months out of school, you know, and in their first job, are they already fed up with it? And that I think as much as anything lately has been what was weighing on me. So I
totally agree. I get a lot of interns and externs, and I also work in a specialty referral hospital that has veterinarian interns. And you know, I see the same thing, and I do worry. And you can wreck the joy of that is, though, that we can, with this experience that we have, and if you're emotionally intelligent, you can recognize that and you can help. I love working with interns, veterinarian interns, as well as tech interns.
Oh, yeah.
But I love working with them because I know that, I mean, some of them are my, I've been doing this as long as you've been alive.
Yep,
I don't like to say that because
I'm at that point too.
That's like super annoying when people say that. You're like, all right. Since I was six is as long as I've been doing this. And I see it, and it's scary. It's very scary. And I try, you know, you try to do what you can to mitigate their feeling of that. But I really do think that these days, they're learning to swim in the deep end of the ocean. Mm-hmm. It's not the same ballgame that we were doing 20 years ago. Nope. So it's hard because you just don't know what to do but be there for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And support them. That's
absolutely.
It.
Well, absolutely.
Well, I think another hard part of that is that it would be so much better if positivity was as contagious as negativity is. Like it takes one person to be negative to bring a whole hospital down, but you need two or three positive people to actually bring a hospital up. I wish that was something that was completely opposite. I wish negativity was so much harder to catch on to than positivity.
That's
is.
A culture that you have to create.
Oh yeah, definitely.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
When I have about 60 technicians and roughly, and two and a half years ago, we went from private practice to corporate, being purchased by Blue Pearl.
Okay.
And
big transition.
Yeah.
I
can only imagine. I've never experienced it. I just can only imagine. Yeah.
And here's the thing, like I could really like rock some people's worlds by saying that I love Blue Pearl. And they've done amazing things for me. And just 2 days ago, we moved into a brand new 20,000 square foot, gorgeous, state-of-the-art, everything brand new hospital. We went from having 6 ICU patients to 19 in within 8 hours. Mm. And so, you know, that's the deep end of the ocean you're really trying to not do that. You know, if you don't want to be here, basically what the attitude that I go into work with every day now is that our old business could not have given us this hospital. They couldn't have.
Yeah.
One reason why they felt the need to give us more opportunity was to sell. And there's no chains on your ankles. You don't have to work here. So I would almost do rather not work here, not because I don't love you and because I think you're an amazing tech, but I don't want you to come here and be negative because it's really exhausting for you and it's really exhausting for us.
Yeah.
And I have that conversation a lot. And I really think that we have had a very large number of staff and managers and doctors leave. But I really think that we're rebuilding this place that I want the culture to be positivity. Yeah. And I can't say, I mean, I'm a realist. I'm almost a little bit more of a negative realist. I had this discussion with my manager the other day because I was like, I'm not being negative. I'm being realistic. you know, I'm not. It's very true.
Right.
And when there is room to be positive, the best thing I can expect of my team on bad days is to shoot for neutral.
Yeah.
And I tell them that. If you want to be negative, go out back, have your 15 minutes, come back in, and just aim for neutral. That's the best I can do for you. And it's very hard. It's very tough. But it's just something that I'm not going to give up on.
Yeah, absolutely.
I have no desire. Yeah. I either have to be part of the solution or I need to step out.
Yeah.
And I'm not ready to step out.
Yeah. So it sounds like your hospital, obviously, this week or the last couple of weeks is undergoing a huge transition in terms of relocation. But like you kind of have been hitting on it a little bit, but what is your, as a manager in that hospital, like what does your typical day look like? Do you do a lot of patient care? Are you mostly more administrative? Do you kind of have a little bit of a balance there with your position there? What does your typical day look like?
Well, I would say, I mean, I'm 100% administrative.
Okay.
However, you will have to drag my dead body off the floor. And I was very clear when I said to my managers that, yes, I will take this manager, you know, I will continue to be a manager, but I'm not going to sit at a desk and tell people what to do. Like, that's just not me. So we don't expect a manager to sit in a desk and give direction.
Right.
We want you to be alongside your staff. And that's completely fine. If somebody calls out sick or somebody is on maternity leave, if I can take a surgery shift or a half surgery shift, or I can fill in an ophthalmology because someone needed to leave, I'm going to do that. I'm going to do my very best where I can throughout the hospital. And it was just recently that I gave up my 12-hour Sundays on the floor because I was an ICU tech for 12 hours on Sundays, which I love. That's my home base, you know, and I any chance I get, I still work every single Christmas. I've worked Christmas for 25 years. And
oh, wow.
I, as a manager, I'm not required to do that, but I choose to do that for a couple of reasons. One, because I want my staff to know that I'm there with them and that, you know, I'm here just like you are. Also, I don't have children, so I know that a lot of people value those days.
Sure.
Not that Christmas doesn't mean a lot to me, but I can see my nieces Christmas Eve and work Christmas Day.
Right.
And allow those people to be at home with their kids because I know that that's important to them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I just think it's important to do that as a manager, just to be there. My role most recently has been chaos only because of the move.
Yeah.
But I would say that it's just a combination of I have a team of supervisors under me, and then I also have, you know, I'm also trying to what you would call build the bench, where you're trying to build leaders in the team so that someday you can build your replacement, right? Because you can't do this forever. But I would say that I'm just constantly putting out fires. You know, there's this happening, there's this happening, there's this happening, and it's all different things. So I'm also managing the people aspect, and I'm also managing the logistical aspect. This anesthesia machine is not working. I need to call this. So it's a lot. It's just a lot of different things. The variety is something that I really like. I do feel a little bit sometimes like I'm pulled in a lot of directions and I can't do one thing well. But again, I have to just refocus and learn to delegate. But my day looks really different depending upon the day.
Sure.
I do have a lot of desk work that I have to do, but I can't sit still very long.
Okay.
We could talk about all this stuff
pretty much
all day, but we brought you on here because we wanted to talk about forensics.
Okay. Absolutely.
So let's start talking about forensics. So what exactly drew you to the field of veterinary forensics or to pursue that? Like you said, the master's degree program kind of happened in the middle of you going for that. So what kind of drew you towards forensics? Was there one particular case that you saw that made you think that this is something I want to go into, or what kind of led to that decision?
Honestly, yeah. I mean, I think part of it was that it was born out of necessity because as an emergency tech, that's where you see these cases that come in as like trauma, or they're just coming through the ER. They're not coming in through ophthalmology, you know?
Right.
It was sort of born out of necessity in one way as an emergency tech and as a manager, because a lot of times if we would get a case where a dog has come in who was, say, beaten with a brick in the head, and it's like, oh my gosh, most people are like, oh my gosh, what do I do? So I would be called for that reason. But also, like I said, I'm a little bit drawn to the dark side of things, and I love true crime. I mean, I'm just going to be honest. Your guys' podcast is incredible, but you're the only tech podcast I listen to. I am obsessed with true crime. In fact, my true crime obsessed podcast is my favorite. next to yours.
Okay. But we'll take that compliment.
Yeah, thank you.
I mean, you guys really brought me out of my comfort zone with the true crime things. Like, I love Dr. Deaths. I love, like, all the crazy, dark, murdery type ones are
to a lot of those myself.
Okay, okay, good. All right, yeah. So I don't feel so weird now, because I was like, I hope you don't think I'm insane or creepy or anything. Okay, good. So that's me. I love dark, murdery things. So, you know, I think all jokes aside, I know that, you know, there is that aspect to it, which is more of becoming like a culture these days. When you're in the ER and you're faced with these cases, I was sad and upset and heartbroken, and I felt every feeling in the world. And all I wanted to do was just make it so that it didn't happen again, make it as best as I could in the situation for the animal. And the best way that I learned how to do that was to get this degree and help to seek justice for these animals, really. Nailing the guys to the wall, girls, whoever they are, you know, whoever they are. The only way we can do that is to make sure that all of our records are clean, make sure that, you know, just the facts, ma'am. This is what we need to do. And I really think that, you know, finding this degree program was just, you know, it was serendipitous, because I really felt like we were seeing so many cases through the emergency room. There actually is one case in particular that has stayed with me. And I just, a couple of weeks ago for Blue Pearl, we had our own CE track, which was incredible. It was like 4 days. There were like 1,600 people that attended from everywhere, not just in the Blue Pearl hospitals, but I did my forensics lecture for that remotely. It was on a Sunday morning at 9 o'clock. And I said, let's just cozy up with some coffee and talk about maggots, you know, so, or animal abuse, you know, at that hour. But it's something that I think people are very interested in, and I think it's just it's necessity. And there is a case that really, it hit me hard, because it's what I call a tip of the iceberg case, where it was a dog that presented. It was severely, severely emaciated and neglected. And when the doctor did not want to report, she was just like, well, you know, the dog died, so do we really have to? Like, doesn't the story end here? You know, she doesn't want to take the responsibility. Plus, these people seemed a little weird. Maybe they might want to retaliate against me. And I'm like, no, we need to call. Like, if you don't call, I'm going to call, that's me. And when she finally called, the animal control officer came out, and who I was familiar with. And he, you know, I did my version at the time of evidence collection. I was like, okay, well, I found rocks in the dog's rectum when I took a temperature, and I know that he's scavenging and eating rocks because he's hungry. It's not that he's sick. Right. He wants to eat anything that's in his presence. So he's filled with rocks and sticks and grass. And it was a 35-pound Dalmatian that should have weighed 70 pounds. And I focus on this case because it's such an excellent example of why it's necessary to have this knowledge. Basically, in a nutshell, he went to the house. There were three other dogs in very similar condition. The owners of the dog were EMT firemen, and there were six children removed from the home. So you can imagine that the children, what they went through, I don't know, because none of that was divulged to us. But just know, you can imagine. And they also, they were EMT firemen. What they did was, when they went on a run, they basically took all the prescriptions in the house. You know, here, we're going to take these to the hospital for you. And then it wound up in a bag, and it wound up on their kitchen counter. One of the evidence photos was literally hundreds of bottles of prescriptions of medications. So they were drug seeking. And it was just it was a tip of the iceberg case, because if they had not brought that dog in, and we had not reported, I don't know what would have happened to the children or the people or the people whose drugs were taken or the other dogs. So it's not an isolated thing that someone just starved a dog. So it most of the time isn't. I mean, that's the case that really sticks with me, that's the reason why I feel necessary for me to be as educated as possible, to be able to collect everything that I need to collect to present, to let someone make a decision on what needs to happen to this person.
Gotcha.
Well, and also just validating your initial thoughts of that saying this isn't right, something's wrong here, and having that evidence come out and having your hunches be validated I don't want to say hunches. That's probably not the right word.
Instincts.
Instincts. Having your instincts be validated just kind of pushes you down that path to say, hey, maybe I have a knack for this. Maybe this is something that I need to do more of.
I mean, it's a passion that I have. And it's like, I know that this is what I was meant to do. And I feel like it just makes sense for me. And I just get it and I love it. And I have gone on to train animal control officers so much that when they would come to my hospital, they're like, should we take pictures of this? And I'm like, oh boy.
Take pictures of everything.
Oh boy. I'm like, oh gosh. Okay. How about if we meet in the library and I can teach you how to do that? But I finally, after years, broke down the door and they now have me as their, you know, I do their onboarding training. So they've had 100% conviction rate once they learn how to collect evidence. So, that's awesome. It's really important. It's just important things. And there's no secrets to it. It's not a secret. It's just a matter of the things you need to know. If you don't know what you don't know, you don't know.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So.
One thing you said in there that really stuck out to me. So I'm originally from California and have maintained my license there. And in California, as a technician, once you become an RVT in California, you are as obligated as a veterinarian to report animal cruelty. And so when you had said, like, if you said it's, I think, to the veterinarian, if you don't report it, I will. In Delaware, do you have any idea what the legal requirement is, if you will, for RVTs? Is there a requirement for them to report that or any sort of support if they do?
That's actually called mandatory reporting, and there usually is combined with an immunity clause.
Okay.
And there are actually 30, it's only mandatory in 36 states.
Okay. I figured it wasn't every state, but.
It is not every state. I wish that it were. In Delaware, it's not.
Okay.
Delaware does not have a mandatory reporting law for animal cruelty. And one reason getting on the Delaware board, I got a lot, I have like really big aspirations because reciprocity for technicians is one.
Awesome.
Title protection is another, and mandatory reporting with immunity clause is the third. And I have been on the board for 4 years now, and I haven't done any of those things. It's really hard to do these things.
Yeah,
and I'm gonna die with a flag on my hill, really, because I'm not gonna give up on these things.
Yeah, for sure.
But I really wish. I mean, I think that how did you feel about that? Did you ever have to do that?
Thankfully, I never did. And the reason why was I felt like the veterinarians that I worked with, if there was something that raised flags enough with me, if it also raised flags with them and the emergency clinic I worked at in California, we were right next door to the city animal shelter. And so we had a really, really, really close relationship with all of the animal control officers that worked for that, and we mostly saw animals from that jurisdiction anyhow, so it was very easy and very comfortable to say, hey, can you just do a wellness check on this particular home or what have you. We never really had to take I would say like a firm stand to make that happen. It was something that thankfully in that environment that I was in was really easy to do. And I mean, I can remember, you know, a couple of things that were very minor and really turned out to not be a whole lot, but certainly not anything like the case you were describing.
Yeah, and that case was that was probably like one of the cases that I went to court with. You know, I had my papers, I was wearing my nice dress clothes, I was in court, I was ready to testify, but they actually pled guilty because they saw our preparation and were like, and the judge saw my photographs and was like, no. We're not doing this. And so they pled guilty. But I understand. I think it's great that there are states that have even technicians that are mandatory reporters Truthfully, the truth of the matter is that the link between interpersonal violence and animal cruelty is, again, something that we could have an entire podcast on.
Oh,
because
for sure. Yeah, absolutely.
You know, there's so many rabbit holes that I could go down with you guys.
Yeah.
We should have a spinoff, I think.
For sure. We should absolutely do that.
Because I, you know, again, one of my favorite topics to talk about is the National Link Coalition, which is one of my teachers named Philip Arkow, who is in the most, he has changed my life. He's an incredible person. And the link between animal abuse, domestic violence, elder abuse, and child abuse is a documented link. And it's a tip of the iceberg situation. And I had no idea. Years ago, I'm like, oh, they starved their dog. They're horrible people.
Right.
Done. I'm going to go home and eat dinner. Like, I didn't know that this world was out here. And I want to, thank you for giving the microphone to talk about this, because I think it's extremely important.
Yeah.
You know, the National Link Coalition, again, if you want a link to put on your page.
Yes, we absolutely do.
We've already written it down.
I mean, it is something that we can do, and that we can, if we know about it, it's also attached to One Health, you know?
Yep.
It's attached to One Health. 60 to 88% of cases where child abuse is investigated, there was also animal abuse. And that's a lot.
Wow.
That's a lot.
Wow.
And it's hard because veterinarians, I think one thing that I want to continue to do is to train my veterinarians and interns and whoever's going to listen to me in what are the red flags? Mm-hmm. What are we looking for? How do I even know? How do I know if that dog was really dropped four times? You know, if it's an Italian greyhound, I'm going to give him a pass.
Sure.
I think his legs are made of beef jerky, but right. I don't know. I'm not sure. But I right. think that besides that, you know, there are red flags that you can look for that you can see. And all you have to do is have the suspicion.
Yeah.
You're not the judge and the jury. You just have to have suspicion. Yeah. And another excellent thing that I don't know if people know about is that AHA actually has a protocol where you create a hospital protocol where you're all on the same page that says, this is what we do when we recognize, and this is what we do when we report animal cruelty, which it really took my hospital from, I would say, in preparation on a scale of 1 to 10, we went from a 3 to a 10. I made evidence collection kits. I have a protocol written for, you know, with my AHA stamp on it, you know, and the doctors get training in that. So it's a hospital protocol that this is what we do. There's a doctor that was also in my class, Dr. Reisman, who works out of the ASPCA in New York. Mm-hmm. And he is also another incredible person who, that is my dream job up there. Don't let my boss hear this, but my dream job is to be his tech. I keep telling him, I'm like, if you ever need a tech, you just let me know. I would love to live in Manhattan, but maybe not right now, but maybe later. But he's basically, you know, a forensic veterinarian, and this is what he does at the ASPCA. And he has written an excellent article on what do veterinarians need to know. Like, it's like in the short 16 pages, this is what you need to know.
Right.
And it's very pertinent. And I print it out for all my new doctors because it's just such pertinent information that it's a basic intro and it's a really good place to start.
Awesome. We will definitely link the AHA thing in there as well. I hadn't noticed that before, so we will
It's not a mandatory protocol,
yeah,
but it
sure.
is a protocol. Yeah.
Sure, sure. When we think about, or when you think about the education you had for your forensics degree, so you said it kind of started out as like a 5-course program, and then while you were in it kind of morphed into a master's degree. Like, what kind of courses or coursework did you have to do or did you have to take that kind of, you know, led to what you're doing now?
They were like the foundational courses.
Okay.
Is where we started. And
okay.
So they tried to sort of cover all areas. They wanted to cover like the psychological aspect, and then they wanted to cover the, you know, evidence collection aspect. So okay. They basically started with, you know, interpersonal violence and animal cruelty, animal law,
okay.
Forensic toxicology. You could also, ooh. As I said, go down the...
Yeah, you said toxicology.
You just really triggered Jeff.
Yeah, for sure.
Let me tell you, my that is... I wish I could be... Even better than that was forensic entomology.
Oh, wow.
Because I love maggots. I really do. I know everyone's... I've just lost about half the people who wanted to even come near me, but it's true, I do. In fact, today we had a case today in the hospital. It was a kitten that was a stray, and its leg was an open fracture with maggots, and most of my techs were like dry heaving, and I'm like, yeah. Okay, here, I'll clean them out. I will pull them out I can stage them for you. I can tell you how long they've been there. We can actually figure out what kind of fly it was that laid these maggots. If you tell me what the temperature was, I can tell you.
Wow.
When they came. So, I mean, you learn all of that. It's incredible. And this sounds like something you might be interested in. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
But the forensic toxicologist who taught the class was incredible. She was incredible. It was amazing. It was hard. It was really, these classes were hard. Let
oh,
me
I
tell
bet.
You, I was
I
in
bet.
With these veterinarians and I sometimes cried. I'm not going to lie. But I had also forensic osteology. I had forensic radiology, I had animal law, we had toxicology, entomology. I mean, we had a lot of, you know, the forensic radiology class was tough because I get very upset with the animal abuse, you know, like it's very emotional and hard. I definitely compartmentalize it and I definitely have to like put on my face of like, okay, we're just going to focus on what matters. And then you go home and cry for 2 days. But the forensic radiology class had a lot of child abuse. For example, if you're talking about forensic radiology and you're talking about repetitive injuries, basically if you have bilateral rib fractures, that's a red flag. Okay. Mm. If you have a child that presents and they're getting an x-ray for pneumonia or coughing and you notice that they have bilateral rib fractures or that they have fractures in multiple stages of healing, those are all red flags for abuse. And so seeing these children, like babies and young children, that I can't handle. Like, I don't, my mom and sister are teachers and they deal with this on a routine basis. And I'm like, nope, I can't do it. Like, I'm not that I'm okay with animal abuse, but I can be there to help. That radiology class had some of that in it, which was real hard, but you're there to focus on learning the things you need to learn. And it is very difficult. You have to get a little bit thick skin for it, but the toxicology was super interesting. And then the wildlife aspect, like I said, was really interesting. And it also has a lot of, you know, you can go down the rabbit hole with those classes as well. Yes. I considered going back and like just for fun, seeing like what it would be like. But again, that's a whole different field and a whole different job.
Gotcha. You said in there that you could, I'd like identify the timeline based on the bugs. And I remember I used to like religiously watch the TV show CSI, and I can remember the head guy on the Las Vegas edition. I remember him saying something to the effect of witnesses lie, but bugs never do.
Yes,
and true. You know, that was his thing, right? Was entomology and like establishing a timeline based on the bugs. And I come from a concrete jungle of Southern California where basically bugs don't exist. So I can't do bugs very well, but like, man, incredible respect for those that can. Holy cow. Yeah.
I mean, I'll tell you, Grissom is kind of where's my husband? Grissom is like my ideal husband. I have the biggest crush on him. I can't tell you. He was very, you know, he was incredible, but that's also one place where I was like, oh my God, look at that. That's great. But it's true. Once you learn what information maggots can provide, you can extract DNA from the GI tract of the maggot. If you're trying to make an identification on a body, not that we would do this on an animal, but on a person, if you found, you know, maggots, you could extract the DNA from the GI tract of the maggot. I think that's fascinating.
Wow.
I also think it's fascinating that they basically burrow in and then they eat the necrotic flesh and they breathe out their butts. I mean, you can't eat and breathe in there. I mean, I think that's fascinating. Like, yeah, I don't know. I think the whole thing is very fascinating. So,
for sure.
But if I could have another life, I probably would be a forensic entomologist, I think.
That's amazing. That's just crazy stuff. You've talked about a few different cases, and I'm just trying to think back in my career, like the number of times where I was at least suspicious of the fact that there was abuse going on. And I can think of a few that were glaringly obvious, like a kitten coming in with, been hit in the head with a bat. That's the one that kind of stands out the most to me. Mm-hmm. And we called about that and all that stuff. How prevalent do you think this is in society to the point of me being someone that's been in the field for 23 years and can only think of a handful of cases where that may have been an abuse case? How prevalent do you think this is? Is this more of a regional thing, or is this a widespread thing that we are just missing?
I think that it's probably more prevalent than most people think. Mm. And I think that as a breed, veterinarians and technicians are very sensitive and a lot of the times willing to give people benefit of a doubt and see the good versus being like me and not trusting anyone and having a dark side. No, I'm just kidding. But I think that it's prevalent. I think a lot of it is not something where you don't just beat your dog in the head and then bring it to the hospital and confess what you've done. Yeah. So unless it's coming through the door with something very obvious, I think it's not something that is really even on a differential list for a doctor, at least the doctors that I work with. I also do agree that it is very regional. I'm just going to say Delaware is in between Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Philadelphia, and New York. So that could be a reason why it is very prevalent here and we're passing through. I mean, we had a dog basically brought from New Jersey. It was a dog fighting dog. He dumped the dog at the at the hospital and like fled back to New Jersey. And he can be brought up on RICO charges because he crossed state lines with the dog, and it is a felony in all 50 states to fight a dog. So like that kind of thing, if you just look at that dog and you don't know what the signs are of a dog who is participated in dog fighting, not dogs fighting, but actual a dog fight, unprofessional or professional kind, you're not going to know. You just think this dog's ears, maybe he got his ears chewed off. Like, who knows? But if you know what the signs are and you know what to look for, again, what you don't know, you don't know. So becoming educated, a lot of people don't want to think about the dark side of people's nature. And you're not going to get a darker side of people's nature than animal sexual abuse, which I don't even like talking about it, but it's something that happens. And I can guarantee you that it's not on the differential list of most doctors.
Right.
I hadn't even thought of that aspect. Yeah.
It's horrifying. You don't want to think about it. And we recently had, in Delaware, we really recently had a case for the local mounted patrol, which was horses. The horses were sexually abused, and it's horrifying. Like most people can't even think about it, and it's not something that you want to think about. So most people don't. But I do think it's more prevalent. And I think if you know what to look for, you could probably see it more often. Mm. I also think that it's not something where people bring to the hospital and go, I accidentally beat my dog in the head,
Right.
I've ruined your night.
No. Okay. I'm just like this reflecting on past cases and
I know. It's not good. I mean, it's not a fun topic, and I'm glad that we're talking about it. Yeah, I know. Again, yeah. It's not for the lighthearted in any way, but it's important. It's so important.
It's very real. It's something that
it's real. Yeah.
If you haven't encountered it yet, you will.
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah.
If you're in this field long enough, yeah.
Well, it's almost like having this discussion where we're kind of peeling back the curtain of things that we are almost hiding and not wanting to look at, and realizing that, like you said, there's probably a lot of stuff that's going on that we're not aware of, and because a lot of us don't have that dark side like you have, Lisa, where we don't all think the worst of people. We all try to think that people have good intentions. But there are people that are out there that are doing these things, and we do need to do something about that as technicians, because what is our oath of technicians is to take care of animals and make sure we're doing the best thing for animals, and not reporting this is not the good thing for animals. So we do have to be on top of this and kind of be more vigilant about it.
Right. Yeah, and it's uncomfortable. I mean, anything that makes people uncomfortable. And I also think that people are not one thing that I feel very proud. I guess proud. I don't know if I'm proud about it, but I can be considered between my LVT, my VTS, and my master's degree, I can be considered an expert witness in court. So I feel like, again, that gives me that I've worked very hard for all of those three things.
Sure.
And it gives me a platform to go in front of a jury and a judge to educate them with facts. That's what I'm going to be doing, is educating. I'm not going to educate them with emotion.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't matter. Right. My emotions play no part in this whatsoever.
Right.
And it's really important that they see it from that side. I need to speak. We're the voice of our patient. If our patient is having surgery and they need post-op meds at 4 hours instead of 6 hours, you need to, I'm training my techs that you need to advocate for your patient. If that doctor doesn't think that your patient is nauseous, but you see saliva pouring out of his face, then you need to figure another way to get across to the doctor that dog needs Serenia and ondansetron.
Right.
This is kind of how I'm training the techs, right? And I'm going to do the same to the judge. I'm going to show him the picture and say, when you have a bilateral rib fracture, getting hit by a car very rarely does that. it's possible, but you can't take, animal abuse off the differential list.
Yeah.
And so I'm very grateful. That's the word I'm looking for, is grateful for the opportunity to be an expert witness and to speak for these animals and help that this doesn't happen again, at least in that instance.
One thing you said in there, recognizing the signs, and especially like right now as technicians, we very likely are the only people, especially in the world of COVID right now, if we're doing curbside check-in and discharge, we are probably potentially the only people that are actually seeing these owners or their automobile. The veterinarians might talk to them on the phone, but they're actually not physically interacting with them. We might be the only ones that are. So again, having that mindset or just being aware of your surroundings, and you know, just especially if you're suspicious, you know, like you said, the bite wounds and you know the hit by cars or the other types of trauma, like kind of keep that in the back of our minds for sure.
Yeah, it lets us collect more information. We're getting more of a perception. And it's funny that you said that, because we had a case recently that was brought out and we had to go to the car to get the animal. My assistant, he's only done this for probably 2 years, and he's, you know, he's in the process of learning. And he came in, I mean, he came in, he's like, "Lisa, I collected all the evidence. I have photos. And I'm like, "Oh my God, I'm growing these little baby forensic techs. I love it. It's amazing." And he had photographs, but then I pulled him aside and I said, "Okay, you did a really good job, but you know what? This is the hard part." It was basically a dog that was in the back of a sedan that was like covered in feces. Like it had like rabbit poop. I mean, it was clearly a hoarder car, and there was a 10-year-old child in the front seat. So again, it gave me the opportunity to, okay, this is not only train him in, this is how you call animal control and you say, this is something that all you need is suspicion. You're not the judge and the jury. You're not the person who's accusing someone of something. Right. You're suspicious. You're reporting your suspicion. And if you're wrong, you're wrong. Which again, you need the immunity for, but we don't have right now in Delaware. You're going to report that, but I also want you to be aware that that child in the front seat could be suffering, and it's that animal control officer's duty, because he has probably a mandatory reporting for children in the job that he has, because it's connected.
Right.
So you have a responsibility right now that you've seen that and you own it, and this is what you're going to do. And he was like, "Oh God," like he I kind of rocked his night, because he was so happy about taking the pictures and everything. I'm like, it's great to collect the evidence, but now what you do with that is very important.
Right. For sure. For sure. So for anybody out there that might be listening that is like, "Yes, this is my jam. This is what I want."
Like me?
Yeah. This is what I want to do. Like, I want to go down a forensics path. I guess two questions I would have is this something, or maybe at least headed in a direction that a technician could probably not necessarily do on a full-time basis, but let somehow integrate into, you know, a career of just doing that? And then also, long before you get to that point, like, where would somebody start?
Well, I mean, there's a lot more even today than there was 5 years ago.
Yeah.
There are some books. There are a couple of veterinary forensic specific books.
Okay.
That you can, if you just literally give it a Google and say veterinary forensic books.
Okay.
I'm sure that on Amazon there are several.
Okay.
I would love to make one for technicians. I would love to do that. That's again end goal in my free time.
Yeah. All that free time.
In all my free time. That is something that you can look at. Honestly, the evidence collection aspect, which I also very much enjoy, is it's very similar to humans. You have your evidence tape, you have to have your chain of command. You know, if you're collecting a bullet out of a dog, if you're listening, surgeons, you don't want to use metal forceps to remove the bullet so that you don't make striation errors.
Oh, wow.
Right? So I have plastic forceps in my evidence collection kit so that they can use the plastic forceps to remove the bullet from the animal. But you can find information like that anywhere, again, for evidence collection, because it's going to be very similar. As far as I haven't really seen any other classes per se. I can't say that for sure, because I think there is another place. It might be like Vetfolio. I'm not sure where it was, but they had like a 5-part class on forensics. I don't know anything about
it. I think it is Vetfolio, to be honest with you.
Is it? You know, if someone's listening and they would like something created, just let me know, because I'd love to do this. But I think that, you know, if you're looking for like hardcore, wanting to learn hardcore forensics the right way, I will tell you that a master's degree is not cheap. And on a technician's salary, it is completely respectable that not only do you need a bachelor's degree, but you know, having to pay for your classes, for your master's, it's not easy to do, but it's possible. But I think just finding resources like CEs. I will also say that the ASPCA works in tandem with University of Florida in their forensics program. And as far as full-time technicians, I do think that I don't know if that's what they spend all of their time doing, or if they're like part-time ER tech / part-time forensics, but I know that they have They have a brand new necropsy room, which sounds really fun. Ooh. Again, I sound like a monster when I say these things.
No.
I really do. I'm like, my mom is probably like, what did you just say? I have no idea where this daughter came from that I have. God. And my sister is just very terrified of me. It's terrible. She's not like this at all. She's like, my God, my sister. Oh, God. Anyway, ASPCA in New York has an excellent, excellent hospital up there where that's what they do. Working with the NYPD, I mean, that's a relationship that you could really use as a model for other areas of how to work with a hospital and animal control and police, because it's incredible what they've done up there. So that's really something to look at as well. But I think you also starting with your local animal control officers, it's very different in each state how it works. You can also go on, like, I think it's animallaw.org, where you can just sort of go down the rabbit hole of the law aspect. Is animal cruelty a felony? What is animal cruelty in Delaware versus New Jersey? It's very state specific. So even just educating yourself in those areas, it's super important. A lot of it you probably do on your own, but I hope that the more interest that's garnered, that it becomes more prevalent just to learn about.
Agreed.
And I'm happy to spread the word any chance I get.
That's great. So we're about ready to get wrapped up here. I know we've taken up a lot of your time today. Is there anything that we haven't touched on yet that you want to get out to our listeners?
Gosh, well, I mean, I think that the only thing just to remember is to just don't be afraid. And the emotions that you feel, I mean, I had so many cases, the Dalmatian still sticks with me, and it's extremely emotional and upsetting, and it's uncomfortable, it's upsetting, it's sad. You get angry. Oh my God, I'm so angry. I mean, I'm just going to be honest. I curse a lot. I mean, as a manager, I really try not to. But again, I'm a realist. You got to get it out. And I'm really mad at these people. Like, I'm just mad at these people who do this. And I have to really stop and take a breath and be like, okay, what is this anger going to do for this world? The world does not need more anger. Right. The world needs somebody to focus on this animal and get justice. If they're not alive, we're going to get them justice because they don't have a voice. And if they are alive, we're going to help make sure this doesn't happen again. And I think that just working through all the uncomfortable things to refocus everything that you're doing as a veterinary technician in this regard, everything is still the same. You're still advocating for your patient in the exact same way you are for anti-nausea meds or pain meds or whatever, except for now you're just talking about something horrible that's happened to them.
Gotcha.
Because I think a lot of my techs are like, oh my God, I can't. I don't want to talk about it. I don't want to do it. It's horrible. I can't look. Yeah. And it's hard. But you just have to kind of work through that. And I respect 150% that if people can't do it, you can't do maggots, you know, like you can't do it. I get it. That's what I'm here for, you know? Yeah. But I also think that just knowing about the link, really the National Link Coalition is just really something people should be aware of.
Yeah.
And for veterinarians to just continue and be brave, because it's hard.
Yeah. And I would say, too, for the technicians, those that are listening that are credentialed, know the laws of your state, whether or not you are in a mandatory reporting state.
I would hope because that you would know that.
Sure. And that's, we always talk about like technician restricted tasks and things that we can do that veterinary assistants can't or have a responsibility to. And whether or not we want the responsibility, that is one many of us certainly have, so we need to make sure we're on the right side of things there. Is there like a particular, I'll say, type of case or profile of, say, of an animal that presents to the ER that you think is easiest to kind of slip through the abuse cracks? Is it like bite wound trauma, or is it like motor vehicle trauma or blunt force trauma? Is there one type of thing that you think is like most likely to not be recognized as actual abuse?
I mean, I think there's a couple. I mean, I think obviously sexual abuse probably would be
okay.
One,
yeah.
As well as trauma, you know? Okay. Yeah. And there are certain types of fractures that should be just raise suspicion. You know, you don't want to confront the owner. You can. I mean, again, it depends on the doctor. Most doctors aren't going to go in and go, did you beat your dog with a golf club? Because this tool mark impression really looks like a golf club. Like, I mean, they're not going to do that. So you kind of have to, once you know the patterns, so to speak, then it makes it so much easier. And once you open up the opportunity to think, could this have been a possibility? you're going to see things that aren't there. You're okay. Also going to start to be like, is every fracture a you know, did you really drop your Italian Greyhound six times?
Right.
Like, you know, probably yes. That,
yeah, probably.
In that case, yes. But if you have another dog who's a pit bull or another large dog who's not easily fractured, you have to question, could that injury have happened the way that the story is being told? Because people lie to us all the time, especially look at even with like the pot dogs that come in and it's like, do you have teenagers? That's the first question you're going to ask, right? Like, so you kind of have to put that thinking cap on of like, what is the possibility? I can't say that there's a generalized profile.
Okay.
Well, Lisa, this has been fantastic.
Oh my
Jeff
gosh.
And I,
could, I could talk about this all night.
Yeah.
I know, me too.
And maybe we will have to do a follow-up somewhere down the road.
Part
I think
two.
We probably will. Yeah,
for sure.
And go into the deep dives of, we could just have an episode and we'll just call it Lisa and Maggots. And
yeah,
we'll just talk about maggots
just
all day.
Deep dives and cases and all that. Because,
it's incredible.
So before we end for the night, we do have one more question. We have the Vet Tech Cafe Would You Rather question.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
Are you ready for this one?
Yeah, absolutely.
Jeff and I actually did a lot of research this afternoon looking for better Would You Rather questions.
Yeah.
And
we found a couple new sites and we found some doozies.
we found some good ones. And the one that Jeff and I both love tonight. Okay, are you ready?
Yep.
Okay, would you rather have hiccups for the rest of your life or the constant urge to sneeze?
Oh my goodness. I really think that's equally horrible.
Yeah, and both pretty miserable.
I'm going to say hiccups. As much as I absolutely don't like it, the sneezing, that's terrible. Like, I had to sort of work through in my head what each one would be.
Yeah.
But I'm going to say I'd just rather hiccup forever.
Yeah. Well, with sneezing, it's going to alter your like behavior. With hiccups, it just kind of happens.
It's not going to be, you can't take a photograph either because you're going to have that like.
Right. You know that like second or two before you sneeze when you're like basically incapacitated. Like you're curled up and you're crunched up. And
I don't think your brain works either.
Yeah. Like
your brain is frozen.
That just sounds miserable.
At least I can function and hiccup, I think.
Yeah, agreed.
Well, and then when you have that urge to sneeze and it doesn't happen, then it's like,
oh, so frustrating.
You can't focus for like 5 minutes because you think it's still going to happen.
Yes.
Well, because you're like, I just want to get rid of it. I just want to get it over with.
Right.
Yep, it's still in there somewhere.
And then sometimes it just freaks me out doing it. Like something, like you might lose control of body parts or something. I don't know. I'm just saying, like hiccuping is,
I make a mess everywhere.
Yeah.
You could possibly make more of a mess. It's true.
Yes.
I'm going to go with hiccups. That's my final answer.
Love it.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your time
and for
sharing all
thank
this with
you.
Us because this is like a segment of, you know, what veterinary technicians can do, again, that isn't well known. And obviously there's a lot of gravity to this type of thing, but the discussions about it are fascinating. And the reality is, whether you are in your first year or your 25th year, if you haven't seen it yet, you will. And and recognizing it and then being active about it. It's just a different way to be a patient advocate. And I think for me, that's a huge, huge take home that's ultimately our job. If nothing else, that is our job. And in this arena, we need to do the same too. So thank you so much for your time. And we will definitely have to do this again because
absolutely. I would love that. I also have a little last request from you guys.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
So, you know, after listening to all of your podcasts, I was going to say like 30. I don't know how many you've done, but it feels like a lot, right?
I think it's 30, yeah.
It's up
okay,
there.
Roughly 30. I think that I would request that you guys make a relaxation tape with your voices. I think that I would definitely, or you could also do books on tape because I find, and this is a true story, I know you're like, you're ridiculous, but I have a very stressful job. Everyone does, but and again, especially if you get a case where you have a dog that's been beaten or something, but listening to your podcast and listening to your voices, you both bring such calm and joy and generosity and peace and grace, you know, and it's really great to hear your voices, but I think you should make a relaxation tape because I would be first in line.
I don't even know what to say to that, but thank you.
Thank you. Yes.
It's true because I could listen to you guys all day long, and some days I do. So there we are.
Well, you're kind of ignoring the fact that both of us are introverts and don't really like to talk all that much.
Yeah.
Well, I am too. It's terrible, but you don't have to. talk to the people. You talk to the tape and then just sell it. I mean, there you go.
Right. God bless the internet for allowing us to sit in our homes and do this.
I mean, it's the silver lining to COVID. Can we just say that too?
Right. That's true. Right. It's very true.
Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, thank you guys. I appreciate it. And thank you for having a voice for us, because it's incredible that you have your microphone.
Thank you so much for being here.
Yes, absolutely. It's great to tell everybody's story. So thank you, everybody, for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe, and we'll talk to everybody soon.
Bye, guys.
Thank you.
We would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. We often talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues. As such, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by us as the hosts or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Lastly, as Dave said during the intro, please like us, follow us, and take a minute to rate and review the Vet Tech Cafe podcast on whatever podcast platform you use. It really does help. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.